From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program, as millions in the Philippines struggle for food and shelter following Typhoon Haiyan, we talk to the Philippine ambassador to the United States.
I also am convinced that climate change has had something to do with this disaster.
We're in Moscow to hear the latest on the plight of the Greenpeace activists. Also today, we speak to the news team turned back by a mob of pro-government protesters in Sri Lanka. And we're on Capitol Hill as federal lawmakers push bills to further restrict access to abortions.
Anytime political leaders decide that they're the experts on medical decisions, I think it's dangerous.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From feature story news in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The chance of timely immigration reform being passed in the United States this year seemingly has just been pushed from slim to none. Only a day after coming back from a two-week holiday and less than 15 days before the end of the legislative year, House Republicans have announced they won't pass immigration reform this year. Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
At a press conference today, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner, said that he will not support any House-passed immigration reform and that he has no intention on discussing the already approved Senate bill. Immigration reform supporters hoped that some sort of negotiation between House and Senate legislators would take place and that ideas from both sides would be incorporated into one project. Hence, having both sides compromising in one legislation that could grant a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented people and fixing the broken immigration system. Religious leaders and political activists have begun a fast in support of immigration reform, and throughout the week, a series of activities will take place that are meant to raise awareness of the current situation of these 11 million undocumented people living in the U.S.
Global concerns continue to center on Typhoon Haiyan and the 11 million people affected by its wrath. A UK plane carrying humanitarian aid has arrived in the Philippines to help with rescue efforts. Our UK correspondent Natalie Powell has the latest.
The plane landed carrying around 9,000 shelter kits for the displaced, and each kit is able to serve a family of five. It's estimated that more than 500,000 people have been left homeless as a result of Typhoon Haiyan, which hit the country on Friday. The UK is also sending a 12-person strong medical team at the request of the Philippines Department of Health. The UN says as many as 11 million people have been affected by the disaster in some way. Despite humanitarian efforts from several countries, aid agencies are warning that the situation could deteriorate and aid is urgently needed as many people are still without food, water and shelter.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting resistance from key American lawmakers on the Obama administration's request to pause the sanctions regime against Iran. At the same time, concerns are rising that the only alternative to a diplomatic resolution to Iran's pursuit of nuclear technology is war. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has an update.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is talking to American lawmakers about the need to not follow through on their promise to increase the sanctions regime against Iran. Congressmen are not being won over by his argument. The White House is warning the American people do not want a march to war, according to spokesman Jay Carney.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. government has officially named Nigeria's Boko Haram and one of its splinter groups as terrorist organizations. The State Department says the move will help to combat the continued violent extremism in Nigeria. Nick Harper reports from New York.
The decision by the Department of State means the Boko Haram and Ansaru groups are now considered as foreign terrorist organizations. The terrorist designation means the U.S. will freeze all their assets in America and block any business transactions with the two groups. Boko Haram, which was founded in Nigeria in 2009, has links to Al-Qaeda and has killed thousands of people in suicide bomb and gun attacks. The Boko Haram splinter faction Ansaru has also been labelled as a terrorist organisation, following its kidnapping and execution earlier this year of seven international construction workers. The State Department described its decision as an important and appropriate step to stop what it called violent extremism in Nigeria.
Barack Obama's approval ratings among American voters have dropped to their lowest levels since he first took office, according to a new poll from Quinnipiac University. The survey also raised new doubts about how much U.S. voters trust their leader. Coffee giant Starbucks has been ordered to pay Kraft Foods nearly $3 billion in damages over a packaged coffee dispute. Kraft attests that Starbucks pulled out early from an agreement to let Kraft sell bagged coffee under the Starbucks name. Starbucks disputes, saying Kraft didn't pull their fair share, but an independent U.S. arbitrator agreed with Kraft. And a painting by British artist Francis Bacon of his friend and fellow artist Lucian Freud has become the most expensive artwork ever sold at auction after it went under the hammer in New York. The three studies of Lucian Freud, painted in 1969 and considered one of Bacon's greatest masterpieces, reached $142 million U.S. dollars at Christie's Auction House. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
We have no water here, and then we just drawing all the resources, just like collecting rainwater, just for the use on emergency cases in our ERs and our OPD.
A Filipino hospital worker in the country's Bogo district on the tough conditions hampering medical efforts. The death toll caused by Typhoon Haiyan, the most powerful typhoon to make landfall in history, now stands at over 2,300, with that number expected to rise. With many millions more affected, the Philippine government has described the rescue and relief effort as the biggest challenge to ever face the nation. Coming up, the Filipino ambassador to the United States tells us about those challenges and the aid his country is receiving from the United States. But first, the latest from the scene of the devastation. Correspondent Paterno Esquemakel of the Filipino website Rappler.com filed this report earlier.
In Hernani, Eastern Samar, 67-year-old Antonio Baful wrestled with Super Typhoon Yolanda. This boxer died fighting, but not in the ring. His final enemy, the strongest typhoon in history. His wife Macrina says he died helping people flee Yolanda's fury.
There was a boulder, then strong winds, then water came rushing in. He fell, he lost consciousness because his head was hit.
Antonio is among thousands killed by the super typhoon. Disaster officials say 2,275 people died, but estimates are much higher.
Residents say over a century ago, waves triggered by a typhoon destroyed this church in Hernani, Eastern Samar. Now this has become a mass grave for victims of Super Typhoon Yolanda.
In this mass grave, Gregorio Culiarga buries his cousin, Silvano, and Silvano's two grandchildren. He says his cousin, Dominador, is missing, but accepts he is probably dead. The three died at the height of Yolanda early Friday. He says their family in Manila knew nothing as of Saturday.
His siblings and other relatives, as well as the children's parents in Manila, don't know that this has happened. If possible, please spread word of what's happened on the internet.
On Sunday, Borongan resident Norma Abukay rushes to her nanny after hearing about the tragedy. She wanted to check on her parents.
When we stopped by my parents' house, the house was just gone. I just cried. I said my parents probably died there. I can't do anything anymore. It's a tragedy.
Her mother is found dead while her father is missing. Super Typhoon Yolanda buries real faces, real stories, real dreams. After taking care of their dead, they now face the struggle of living. Paterno Esquemakel, Rappler, Eastern Samar.
Correspondent Paterno Esquemakel of the Filipino website Rappler.com. And you can find lots more information about the typhoon on their website. Again, it's at Rappler.com. The US response to the typhoon continues to gear up with naval ships led by the USS George Washington en route to the waters of the Philippines. The United Nations has had a long, complex history with the country that includes a period of occupation in the 19th century, then a close alliance forged in the Second World War. Earlier today, FSN's Simon Marks talked to Jose Quisha, the Filipino ambassador for the United States, at the country's embassy here in Washington.
it seems that, again, the damage that has been caused would probably be among the worst, if not the worst, tragedy that we would have suffered.
And given the devastation that was wrought not just to communities, but also to communications infrastructure and local government infrastructure, there are presumably still whole areas that you haven't been able to reach, that you don't have accurate information from, and that must be posing additional complexities in terms of the response.
Yes, to some extent. I think in terms of communication, cell phone signals, for example, have been restored. Certainly, there are areas where power is still not available. Airports that were closed initially have been reopened. We are fortunate that the U.S. government has sent relief and rescue teams to particularly to the hardest hit area, which is Tacloban City.
And 6 days on from this, with so much of the reporting from the scene suggesting a growing sense of frustration among survivors about aid deliveries, is it your sense that that picture is about to change?
Well, we are, of course, hopeful, but because, as I said, there are opening airports, for example. Before, that was a challenge because they could not transport goods. But I think that is being addressed by the government right now.
And what are you doing here in the embassy about the Filipino community in the United States, where there must be large numbers of people very anxious to trace relatives and loved ones who are missing?
Well, we're fielding calls from the Filipino-American community at the embassy, as well as our consulates around the U.S. Of course, because of the number, we may not be able to handle all the calls right away, but we also have the website, and we are also referring them to this Google website, which is Google People Finder /2013 Yolanda.
But it could be a while.
Yes, because they would rely on the agency, the government agency that's putting together all these lists. So I understand some of them have been able to find the names.
Now, President Aquino, in an interview yesterday, made a point of saying that you cannot ignore the role that global warming is playing in the changing weather conditions that may have contributed to the magnitude of this typhoon. And he rapped the knuckles of the developed world for not having done enough to deal with global warming thus far. Does an event like this help propel that debate further?
Well, we are hopeful because there's, in fact, a climate change conference in Warsaw that will be taking place soon. And I'm pretty sure that this issue will be taken up.
And when the history of this tragedy is written and the U.S. response to it is examined, do you think in any way the outcome will alter a narrative in the Philippines that saw the United States, for example, having to leave Subic Bay? Do you think that in the minds of people, the United States' reputation in the Philippines will change as a result of this?
Well, I don't want to speculate. The entire international community could certainly do much more in terms of environmental protection, eliminating gas emissions and so on. I also am convinced that climate change has had something to do with this disaster. And not only this one, we had an earthquake. What we're seeing is that there's more frequent typhoons in our country, and the magnitude of the earthquakes that we've been experiencing are also much stronger. I just feel that climate change has contributed to that.
Ambassador Quisha, thank you very much indeed for talking to us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ambassador Jose Quisha of the Philippines, talking this morning with FSN's Simon Marks. With an eye on next year's midterm election, several state and federal lawmakers are pushing bills that would further restrict access to abortion. In response, Senate Democrats introduced the Women's Health Protection Act, which would make it illegal for states to impose burdensome regulations on abortion clinics and require women to undergo unnecessary procedures when seeking abortions. These bills will compete for space on the already jam-packed congressional calendar as the nation's federal courts hear several major cases concerning women's rights to make reproductive choices. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has the story.
More than 100 women's health activists came from across the country Wednesday to lobby their representatives on Capitol Hill to protect and, in some cases, expand access to contraception and abortion. One of them, Kiara Johnson with the youth advocacy group Choice USA, said she's asking lawmakers to push back against both longstanding and newly introduced restrictions on abortion, including a bill introduced by Senate Republican Lindsey Graham just last week to ban all abortions nationwide after 20 weeks of pregnancy.
Anytime political leaders decide that they're the experts on medical decisions and family conversations and decisions, I think it's dangerous.
Graham's Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act only includes exceptions for cases of rape, incest against a minor, or when the mother's life is in danger. Johnson says this proposed law, which has already been enacted in several states, violates the U.S. value of equal protection under the law.
This disproportionately affects young women, low-income women, you know, women who are uninsured, women who live in great distances from a health care provider, because if you don't know you're pregnant, right, you don't know that you need, right, an earlier abortion. And unfortunately, far too many women are struck out. They no longer have the opportunity to make the decision that's best for them.
As dozens of state-based abortion restrictions advance in Texas, Virginia, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Oklahoma, and many other parts of the country, a group of progressive lawmakers in the House and Senate announced a new bill Wednesday that would block future restrictions and allow existing ones to be challenged in court.
The Women's Health Protection Act creates federal protections against state restrictions that fail to protect women's health and intrude upon personal decision-making.
That's Wisconsin Democrat Tammy Baldwin, one of the bill's lead sponsors. She said Wednesday that she's motivated to support the measure by what's happening right now in her home state.
Women and their doctors are facing a slew of new and radical restrictions to health services that have been passed by our Republican legislature and signed into law by our Republican governor. Most recently, our governor signed a law that not only forces women to undergo unnecessary medical procedures, but also imposes unreasonable requirements on the doctors that deliver care to these women. This extreme mandate would force several Wisconsin health clinics to shut their doors and others to reduce services, leaving many women out in the cold. These politicians in Wisconsin and in many other states across the country are doing this because they think they know better than women and their doctors. But the fact is that they don't.
Many different legal battles over how much a state can restrict access to abortion appear headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The high court rejected one such bid from Oklahoma this Tuesday after a lower court ruled the state's policy of forcing women to have an ultrasound before getting an abortion was unconstitutional. Following that announcement, those both for and against sweeping abortion restrictions passed in Texas earlier this year are now petitioning the justices to hear their case. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Scores of ethnic Tamils have been stopped by Sri Lanka's military from entering the capital ahead of a Commonwealth summit. The protesters, there to highlight the plight of thousands who lost loved ones in the decades-long separatist war, were turned away as government leaders gathered in Colombo. A TV crew for Britain's Channel 4 News, also in Sri Lanka, faced a pro-government protest, accusing the channel of supporting the defeated rebels. Earlier, I spoke to the editor of Channel 4 News, Ben DePere, who told me that an organised mob were awaiting their arrival.
We got on a train early this morning from Colombo to go north to northern Sri Lanka. We've been told we could go anywhere we wanted in Sri Lanka. We are quite well known here as journalists because we've reported the end of the war and have done a number of investigative documentaries and reports on what happened at the end of the war here. The United Nations estimates 40 to 100,000 people were killed in the final days of the war. We got on a train. We were followed on by secret policemen or intelligence or whatever you want to call them, as we are pretty much wherever we go here. We were on the train for about 3.5 hours. We reached a place called... we reached a town which was about two-thirds of the way to our destination called Anuradhapura. And on the way into the station on the train, we could hear a big demonstration. There were perhaps 200, 300 people who surrounded the train, shouted anti-Channel 4 slogans, and then boarded the train and surrounded us. They stayed on the train for about an hour and a half. The police turned up. The police asked us to go. When it became obvious to us that they weren't going to leave without us leaving the train, and therefore we were stopping lots of people from getting home to the north of Sri Lanka on a very long train journey, we left the train. We were then surrounded by the mob, and we were escorted to a police van and taken elsewhere. The police van wanted to take us to Colombo. We didn't want to go to Colombo, so we have taken refuge elsewhere.
And this is all happening ahead of this week's Commonwealth Summit.
It's happening. I mean, William Hague arrived today almost at the same time our train was mobbed. William Hague, the Foreign Secretary, the British Foreign Secretary, has argued that Britain should be part of CHOGM and come to this meeting because they need to engage with Sri Lankans and get to engage in the Commonwealth's core values, which are open government, democracy, and the rule of law, none of which we've experienced ourselves, really.
But the United Kingdom and many other representatives stopped short of boycotting this event.
William Hague has been meeting with Sri Lankan ministers all day, and I have just been speaking to one of his aides because the Sri Lankan nightly news in English showed the pictures of us being taken off the train this afternoon and described us in English and showing our faces as Tamil Tiger supporters. And that is a hugely dangerous thing to say in this country.
Speaking to me from Sri Lanka, Channel 4 news editor Ben DePere. Now, the 28 activists and two journalists seized in the Arctic in September have been moved to St. Petersburg. They remain there in pre-trial detention, awaiting possible hooliganism charges amid international uproar. It's been speculated that their move to Russia's second city might be aimed at dampening some of that criticism. Greenpeace has disputed the seizure of the ship and crew from the start, and the Netherlands has raised the issue with an international court. Our Moscow correspondent Tom Barton has the story.
The saga of the so-called Arctic 30 moves south. Transported by train prison carriage from Russia's northern port of Murmansk, the crew of the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise have been hurried into pre-detention compounds in St. Petersburg. Alexander Zubov, spokesperson for the St. Petersburg Prison Service, says this will mean improved conditions for the 28 activists and two journalists.
The arriving detainees arrested within this criminal case will get all the conditions provisioned by Russian law and international norms and regulations. These are standard cells. As far as this particular detention centre is concerned, all the cells are standard, absolutely the same, 8 square metres provisioned for two persons.
It was September the 18th when Coast Guards from Russia's FSB, the successor to the KGB, abseiled down from a helicopter onto the deck of the Arctic Sunrise and held all on board at gunpoint. The crew, from 18 countries around the world, had been protesting Russian state oil giant Gazprom's attempts to drill for oil in the Barents Sea, which they consider a disaster waiting to happen. Towed to Murmansk, all 30 were charged with piracy, which carries a maximum 15-year prison sentence. As the world recoiled in horror, the Arctic 30, as they were coming to be known, began describing their 23-hour confinement in freezing cells at their detention centre in the Russian Arctic. They are still in so-called quarantine now, says Dmitry Artemonov, head of Greenpeace St. Petersburg.
Our activists are currently held in quarantine, and while in quarantine, it is more complicated for lawyers to visit them. And so far, we do not have any information from the lawyers about the visits, nor about the conditions in the detention centre.
Now in St. Petersburg, the Arctic 30 are still charged with hooliganism, which could get them up to 7 years in prison. Debate rages around the case. The Arctic Sunrise was in international waters when it was seized. Greenpeace maintains that was illegal. So does the government of the Netherlands, under whose flag the Arctic Sunrise was flying. They are attempting to get the 30 and their ship freed through the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea in Hamburg, Germany. The Russian government says the protest, involving two activists trying to scale the side of the oil rig, broke the law. As for the Arctic 30, their fate remains uncertain as lawyers worry about mistreatment and overcrowding in their new detention centres, and questions loom about the territorial problems involved in the case. Speculation is growing about whether Russia will give up and drop the charges, or if they don't, just how heavy the price will be that prosecutors try to extract from these environmental activists. Tom Barton, Moscow.
This week marks the 44th anniversary of the very first message sent over ARPANET, the precursor to today's internet. Part of the computer that sent the message continues to sit in a lab at the University of California, Los Angeles, where one of the internet's founding fathers still teaches. Lindsay Mastis reports from Los Angeles.
It's a military-hardened machine.
79-year-old Leonard Kleinrock stands next to what looks like a big refrigerator with a few switches on the front.
They're made out of plastic these days. This is steel.
The machine is called an IMP, Interface Message Processor. It's like a modern-day router. Kleinrock and a student programmer used it to send the first message from UCLA to Stanford University 44 years ago.
We typed the L, and we said, "Do you get the L?" Got the L. Get the O? Got the O. Type the G. Crash! The system went down.
Kleinrock says the first message was supposed to be log, as in log in.
So what was the first message ever on the internet? Lo, as in lo and behold. Our message turns out by accident, in my mind, to be something that will be remembered for generations.
The only record of this transmission was written by hand in a logbook.
No photograph, no sound recording, just this.
ARPANET, as it was called, was the precursor to today's internet and was designed with the U.S. Department of Defense during the Cold War.
The urban myth is it was to protect us against a nuclear attack by the Russians, that if they attacked us, we wanted a network that would survive. False. That was not the reason the ARPANET, hence the internet, was created. It was there to do as I suggested, namely, that if you're a researcher and I'm a researcher and I want to use your resources, a network will connect us and I can share them. Totally experimental, scientific, not related to defense at all.
The internet has changed quite a bit since 1969, but Kleinrock hasn't. He's still teaching computer science as a distinguished professor at UCLA, and one of his joys is showing students the machine that started it all.
It's ugly inside. It is so ugly, it's beautiful. You have to love it. And it has this wonderful odor. It's got that old technology smell, which is unique to this machine. And whenever I smell that, I think of those early days.
What does it smell like? What's close to it?
It's not quite mold.
Kleinrock says if he were to do it all over again, there is one thing he'd change. He would have required strong user and file authentication to make the internet more secure. Lindsay Mastis, Los Angeles.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact the program by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, at Feature Story. Coming up on Thursday, a Pakistan journalist tells us about surviving assassination attempts in the name of objective reporting. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.